I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. After winning enough delegates to be the Republican presidential nominee, Donald Trump spent the last few weeks giving GOP leaders heartburn. He questioned whether the judge overseeing the lawsuit against Trump University would be fair because of his Mexican heritage. The judge was born in America and is of Mexican-American heritage, causing the House Speaker to say Trump's comment was a textbook definition of racism. More recently, he fired his controversial campaign manager, and an FEC report shows his campaign has just $1.3 million on hand and that it paid more than $1 million last month to companies owned or controlled by Donald Trump. Yesterday, he gave a speech calling Hillary Clinton a world-class liar and the most corrupt person to ever run for president. Today on the show, Donald Trump and the GOP with the convention just a month away. Joining us are Charlie Giroux. He's a conservative columnist, a Republican strategist, CEO of Quantum Communications. That's a public affairs firm in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. He's also a Republican delegate. And Charlie, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
And also with us is Howard Fineman. He's global editorial director of the Huffington Post Media Group. And Howard, it's been a while. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be with you, Marty.
Howard, let me begin with you. Is Donald Trump's campaign in trouble?
Well, obviously, yes, but not necessarily terminally so. The fact is that he's spent a month or more making big-time mistakes all over the place that have been criticized by Republican leaders. You mentioned Paul Ryan. There have been others who have done the same thing. The Republican establishment is probably no closer to embracing him now than they were when Trump essentially won the nomination. He's not raising money, as you pointed out, and he continues to make statements that have hurt him politically, not helped him politically. But all that said, if you look at polling in individual states, including Pennsylvania, Donald Trump is very much in the ballgame, so it's way too early to say that he's in any kind of terminal trouble. There's several months to Election Day, and a week is a lifetime in politics.
Charlie, you're a delegate to the Republican National Convention. Where do you stand on Donald Trump?
Well, I'm an alternate delegate. The Trump people won in my congressional district. I was not one of them. As you may know, Marty, I was the national co-chairman of Carly Fiorina's campaign.
That's right.
But the thing that troubles me right now, and frankly, there's not much to argue with Howard on, he hit it pretty well on the head, is the fact that the Trump campaign blew a five-week head start. And Howard's correct. In politics, a week is a lifetime, so 5 weeks is, you know, an eon. And they had a tremendous opportunity to coalesce, unite the party, put the mechanics in place that we're missing, organize a ground operation, et cetera. And instead, we spent 5 weeks talking about the federal judge, which was wandering into the weeds, even if he hadn't made the outrageous statements that he did about the judge personally. Getting off onto that tangent of his own personal legal problems was an unforced error, to use a baseball metaphor.
But Charlie, how much loyalty do you think Donald Trump has to your party, to the Republican Party?
Well, that's for him to answer, not for me. I mean, he was, as you know, a Democrat for much of his life and still holds, in the view of many, a lot of Democratic views. So I don't know how much loyalty he has to the party. He made some statements a couple of weeks ago, or I guess a week ago, where he said that, you know, he was prepared to, quote unquote, go it alone.
Right.
I think he's, as he has with so many statements, walked that back a little bit. But, you know, that really is in his hands to demonstrate how much loyalty or lack thereof he has to the Republican Party.
Howard, you did an interview with Paul Manafort, who was called in, what, essentially to oversee, to run the campaign? What's his actual job?
Well, I think having spent a fair amount of time around Donald Trump in his campaign and having known him a little bit beforehand, nobody runs Donald Trump. And that's both the virtue and the problem here. Paul Manafort is somebody who's been part of the Trump outer circle for many years because Trump does a lot of international business, and mostly what Paul Manafort has done in recent years is international consulting with various figures around the world, including the president of the Ukraine and so forth. And they have mutual friends, including a guy named Tom Barrack, who is an international investor. And as the Trump campaign was floundering around a few months back, Tom Barrack suggested to Donald Trump that maybe it's time to bring Paul Manafort in. So Manafort was brought in as, quote, chairman while Corey Lewandowski, the campaign manager, remained as campaign manager. And one of the reasons why, one of the many reasons besides Donald Trump himself, why things have been so screwed up is that there was basically a tug of war between Manafort and Lewandowski. Manafort has now won that battle. Lewandowski's out. And a lot of the old-time, shall I say, political operatives that Paul Manafort has known for decades, going back to the time when Paul Manafort, was very much involved in U.S. politics, are back and around Donald Trump. So yesterday, Donald Trump gave a fiery speech, but one that was in a traditional context, scripted, read from a teleprompter, making all of the carefully vetted talking points about Hillary Clinton that he wanted to make. So it was the first time I thought that it looked like a more traditional campaign. But that's just on the surface. They still got to raise all the money. They still got to do the diplomacy with the Republican establishment. They still got to raise money for the party. The fact is, Donald Trump doesn't care about the Republican Party. Donald Trump doesn't care about a lot of things that are traditional in American politics, parties, rules, rhetoric, decorum, et cetera. Trump is a threshing machine, and he's going to continue to be that.
A threshing machine and potentially hurt the Republican Party, Howard?
Well, I think if you talk to a lot of Republicans, yes, absolutely, because he doesn't really think in those terms. He doesn't think, gosh, it's my duty now to go out and raise hundreds of million dollars for Republican House and Senate candidates, even if they wanted me to. He doesn't care about that. He only cares, to use another metaphor, the Republican Party is merely the tee for his golf ball.
Let me go back to you, Charlie. We don't have time to take apart his speech or spend, I don't want to spend the whole hour on it. And it seems to me there are things that Hillary Clinton can be criticized about. But when you call, and I'm talking about Donald Trump here, the most corrupt, the worst liar, leaving the ambassador in Libya alone to sort of die as he did, but sort of blaming it on her that he somehow died alone in Libya, then when you speak in those superlatives, you kind of lose the actual message that I think is one that would make some sense.
Well, the actual message is, Marty, that you simply cannot trust Hillary Clinton. And that's a message that has been received and understood, believed, and imparted by the vast majority of the American people. I mean, Hillary Clinton's numbers ain't that good either. And the number one problem that she has is that simply people do not trust her. So in that regard, I think Trump's remarks yesterday were right on point and drove the message that he has to drive. But to Howard's point, well made a moment ago, while he was scripted yesterday and more measured and careful in his approach, he has done that before and then very, very quickly shifted back into the Donald Trump that we all know, which is shooting from the lip and oftentimes to his own disadvantage.
Howard, let me go back to you. And it is clear that both candidates have high negatives. I think Donald Trump's is around 70, Hillary Clinton's around 50 or 55. What do you make of that, especially make of that in mid-June?
Well, what I make of it is it would be foolish to write Donald Trump off, despite all of what we've just said, because this is a toxic environment. Most voters don't like either of these people. They like Trump a little less, but they don't like or trust either of them. And yes, Hillary's big issue is trust. Trump's big issue is a dangerous looseness and however you want to describe it, unfit for office. That's the framework, and that's a very dismal a choice to present to the American people at a time when two-thirds or more of the American people think the country's going off in the wrong direction. The country, the people in the United States think that America's headed in the wrong direction, and yet the two choices, the basic two choices presented to them in the fall, are ones that they don't like. So if anything, it just reinforces the negativity and the sort of smoldering resentment out there in the electorate, which makes this a very unpredictable time.
Charlie, in the speech yesterday, Donald Trump, in a sense, called on Bernie Sanders to join his movement, I guess going from the revolution to the movement. Do you think that will have any kind of appeal?
very limited and very short term. I mean, ultimately, the people that were for Bernie Sanders were for him for reasons other than simply being fed up with the establishment or angry about the direction that the country is taking, as Howard so correctly pointed out. I think this is really the problem for the Trump campaign, is that this is a nose-holder election. And if it weren't, Hillary Clinton would be toast. I mean, the record of this administration, of which she was a part, her own personal record, would make her eminently beatable by a wide variety of Republican candidates. Instead, this is going to be, I think, a very close election. I think Howard's right. To write off Donald Trump at this point would be foolhardy. There is so much time to go and so many, you know, bumps along the road as we get there, that, you know, particularly in a place like Pennsylvania, which I know you want to get to,
yep,
this could still be a toss-up state, which in and of itself is remarkable because it really wasn't in the past couple of cycles with much more mainstream candidates running on the GOP side.
Howard, are the trust issues with Hillary Clinton about the server? Is it about her long career in politics, about what she said in Bosnia? Help us understand that.
Well, it's the problem that the Clintons, as a brand, have had from the beginning. But it's one that Bill Clinton was able to overcome with charm and political deftness and a certain joy about politics and ability to connect with people in public. Hillary shares the downsides of the brand, which is somehow that the Clintons are always taking shortcuts somewhere. I mean, that's the, basically, if you look at focus group stuff, that's what it is. Hillary shares the downside of that without very much of the upside in terms of charm and public political skill. People who know her in private adore her, her close friends, but that doesn't translate publicly. So there's that, and there's also the fact, as we've been discussing, that after 8 years of Barack Obama, a Democrat should be very vulnerable. And his history shows that it's hard for any party to maintain the White House for three successive terms, and Hillary is bearing that. And there's also the fact that the basic Clinton consensus, what I call and others call Clintonism, which is a sort of uneasy but real alliance between big business, Wall Street in particular, and the Democrats, that alliance politically is out of gas. And people are searching around on both parties for something to replace it.
Howard, we're almost having a break here. Do you think she's a world-class liar, as Donald Trump said yesterday?
No. I mean, look, Hillary's within the normal bounds of American politics. But Donald Trump's whole approach is to paint everybody as outside the normal bounds of politics, because that's where he himself is. And he's going to drag everybody else into, as you say, the use of superlatives and hysteria in debate. That's where we're headed, and if it ends up being, if the tone and tenor of the debate ends up being dictated by Donald Trump, then that also is going to make it a close election.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Howard Fineman, Global Editorial Director of the Huffington Post Media Group, and Charlie Giroux. He's a conservative columnist, a Republican strategist, is based in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and he is an alternate delegate to the Republican convention. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We are talking about Donald Trump and the GOP with Howard Fineman and Charlie Giroux, and you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Charlie, let me go back to you. There are times watching and listening to Donald Trump over the last year, or certainly within the last month or so, where I wonder sometimes whether he is trying to sabotage his own campaign for the White House. What do you think about that?
Well, he certainly has said and done some things that are at best bizarre. And, you know, one of the well-kept secrets of my life is that I'm a Latino. And I was deeply offended, as were so many others, by his comments about Judge Curiel. But you have to stop and wonder why. And, you know, the point that I have made as a communications professional is that he never should have wandered into the weeds in the first place. Mm-hmm. To go off on the tangent of talking about a fraud trial regarding Trump University was a gigantic mistake when the focus should have been squarely upon Hillary Clinton, because she does have incredibly high negatives, and the way to defeat her is to simply drive those negatives higher.
But isn't that part of a pattern? I'm thinking of a couple of years ago, and he was Donald Trump was a birther. I mean, he was, you know, a very outspoken birther, raising questions about President Obama's birth certificate.
He was. I mean, I'm not going to defend those things that Donald Trump has done, which are indefensible, Marty, if you got me on for that purpose.
No, I didn't. I just
You got the wrong guy.
I am trying to figure out how Republicans struggle to understand their candidate.
I'm pretty sure, by the way, that when he was making those pronouncements, he was a Democrat, as were the leading birthers in this country, just for the record, including a couple from here in Pennsylvania.
Interesting. I mean, I guess the question, Howard, and perhaps I'm, you know, working out of the wrong playbook here, which is, you know, how, and especially with coming into the general election where you have to appeal to a different kind of voter, will Donald Trump be able to make that pivot?
Well, two things. First of all, to try to answer your previous question, I too have wondered sometimes if Trump is trying to sabotage his own campaign, that he doesn't really want to be president, that the whole thing was just a brand extension exercise. But if that might have been the case a while back, I think now he's in it to win it. But he wants to win it on his own terms. And his own terms are to continue. You said he started with birthers. You're right. He started with birtherism. And in many respects, his campaign is just a number of concentric circles around the original birther charge. I mean, he is running a campaign based on fear of the other, fear of people who aren't like him. And that has a lot of appeal in this country right now for a lot of reasons. Immigration, national security, global trade, the sense that a lot of people have in a lot of parts of the country, including a lot of parts of Pennsylvania, that that they have lost their ability to control their own destiny because of outside forces, because of the Chinese, because of global trade, because of immigrants, because of ISIS, because of national security. Mm-hmm. Trump is appealing to that, and he's going to apparently thinks he can win primarily by appealing to that fear, and that is mostly among older white people. Not exclusively, but their plan is to maximize white turnout, get just enough Hispanic turnout in just enough places to eke through a Electoral College victory. But attacking a Mexican-American a judge is not the way to boost your Hispanic turnout.
And we might be getting ahead of ourselves here, Charlie, but I think everyone agrees that Pennsylvania could be a battleground state along with a couple of other states. Again, it's mid-June, so I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. But what is unique, I guess, about Republican politics in Pennsylvania?
Well, I don't want to say, you know, that it's Republican politics in Pennsylvania. And in many respects, the Trump appeal here, Marty, is among Democrats. And just parenthetically, because, you know, there's this suggestion that the birther movement was a Republican plot of some sort. The birther movement was, in point of fact, the Hillary Clinton supporters in Pennsylvania. And I can give you the names if you'd like them. But the Democratic State Committee people who brought the first suit on the birth issue were Hillary Clinton supporters here in Pennsylvania who were doing it on her behalf. So I just want to make that point.
Sure.
And the Democrats here in Pennsylvania have an interesting history. If you go back 40 years, George Wallace very nearly won the Democratic primary in Pennsylvania, lost it to Hubert Humphrey by, I think, 2 points. I'd have to go check. And not that long thereafter, won the Maryland primary just to our southern border. And in the Commonwealth, you know, Ronald Reagan did exceptionally well here among the quote-unquote Reagan Democrats. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you take James Carville's famous description of Pennsylvania as being the cities of Philadelphia and Pittsburgh with Alabama sandwiched in between, Alabama has spread out into the southwest corner of Pennsylvania, a traditionally Democratic stronghold which has rejected Hillary Clinton because of coal, most notably, but also because of guns, and furthermore because of natural gas. And you've got Democrats there voting Republican generically now, but also very, very enthusiastic about Donald Trump. And if I may make one more point before I turn it back to Howard, the Republican primary here was an eye-opener for me, because Donald Trump ran the table, carried every one of Pennsylvania's 67 counties, something I didn't believe was possible, particularly in the suburban rim around Philadelphia. But he carried, you know, Bucks County with, I think, 58% of the vote, if I remember correctly. Montgomery County, you know, Chester County. You can understand Delaware County in some respects, but those other counties really were eye-openers for me in terms of the breadth of his appeal. So the Quinnipiac poll, which shows him still, after the relatively disastrous last few weeks that he's had, essentially tied with Hillary Clinton in Pennsylvania, doesn't surprise me.
And sounds like it doesn't surprise you either, Howard.
No, since everybody's revealing things about their background, I'll say that I'm a Pittsburgh native, so I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, and I go back there all the time, and I have lots of friends there, and I was just there about a week ago with some people in the know in Pittsburgh having lunch, and I said, "Can Donald Trump win Pennsylvania?" And they said, "Absolutely, absolutely." And I think it's for the reasons that Charlie laid out. I think he laid it out perfectly. What's going to happen is that all the leadership of the union movement and what's left of it are going to be on paper, and I think genuinely enthusiastically for Hillary Clinton. But a lot of the rank and file and a lot of non-union, their fellow non-union workers are going to vote for Donald Trump.
And that's
how. By the way, the.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No,
I was just going to say the gun issue. You mentioned the gun issue. I assume at some point we're going to talk about the demonstration on the House floor. That's great for House Democrats, not necessarily great for Hillary Clinton, Pennsylvania.
In fact, we will, and we've got some sound queued up as well. That's Howard Fineman. He's Huffington Post global editor, also with us, Charlie Giroux, Republican strategist. And we are talking about presidential politics, focusing largely on Donald Trump, certainly talking about Hillary Clinton as well. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get a couple of callers on. We got some comments coming in. We have, looks like James from Chester County joining us. Hi, James. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? I think a large issue that Donald Trump has with the Republican Party is that he really does represent what they're thinking and believing, even the snideness in which he delivers it. And it was covered by dog whistle politics for so long, but I think he really clearly represents them, and they don't like that. And I just refer to Donald Trump as a rhetorical coward. You know, he wants the benefit of bombast and hyperbole in the news cycle, but he doesn't want to own any of the things that he says. And I mean, let's face it, the things that come out of the mouth of the President of the United States have a global ripple effect. So I just wanted to make those two statements.
James, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Charlie's saying that Donald Trump perfectly represents the Republican Party.
Well, I mean, there's your snideness and snarkiness, if you want it, for the morning, Marty. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the reason Pennsylvania is as close as it is because of Donald Trump's appeal to Democrats, not to the core base of Republicans. There are still a lot of Republicans in Pennsylvania to whom he has to make the sale.
Let me read a tweet, and I'm going to put this to you, Howard, because this is something that Charlie said. A tweet from Janice says, "What? The birthers were not Democrats!" Exclamation point. Can you speak to that, Howard?
Well, I can't really. I've got to say, the first time I paid any attention to the issue, I didn't know about that Pennsylvania episode that Charlie was mentioning. But
let me mention the names, Howard.
Sure.
Philip Berg, B-E-R-G, who is a Democratic State Committee member from Montgomery County and part of Hillary Clinton's 2008 campaign, brought what I believe, and I don't have it in front of me, so if I'm wrong on the technicalities, somebody can call and correct me, but I believe he brought the first federal lawsuit, and I think it's one of the two or three that are still extant.
Oh, it's still extant. Well, that's interesting. And sort of, I guess, left over from that, the Pumas, I guess, that were up against Barack Obama 8 years ago. Let me get Gary from Malvern to join our conversation. Hi, Gary. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I'm a Republican, but I asked this question of your guests. What do you think is going to happen? Well, everybody's often people are talking about how he's drawing people to the Republican Party. oh, he's going to be like America's Messiah. He's going to solve all these problems, some of which are conflicting. What do you think is going to happen if he doesn't come across?
Meaning if he loses?
No, if he's actually made president. If he actually is made president and he doesn't come across with all these promises, what do you think is going to happen with these very intensely feeling pro-Trump people?
Howard, can you take that?
Well, let's back up, and I would prefer to look at the possibility. Yeah, we can talk about that, but that's way down the road. Let's talk about what will happen after he stirs these passions if he loses. What he's doing here is he's going to, you have to look at it now in terms of the Electoral College. You have to look at it state by state and demographic by demographic. He's going after older, white, culturally conservative voters. He'll have them in the South because that's the way it is in the South. He'll have it in parts of the mountain states in the Midwest. But he's going to focus on places like Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Michigan on the theory that the combination of workers disgruntled about trade and fearful about immigration and worried about national security and being more traditional and so forth culturally is going to somehow be his army that's going to allow him to pull this upset. And he's going to make it as emotional and apocalyptic as he possibly can. That's where this whole election is headed. I actually wonder who's going to be able to govern America, let alone speak to the world after this election. I think it's going to be one of the most disruptive, nastiest, and essentially unproductive of consensus that we've ever seen. That's about as far as I can go at this point.
Charlie, do you see it that way? That's a pretty dark scenario.
I do, and I think James asks a very good question, and I think Howard gave a very good analysis. The reason that Trump is going to look at states like Pennsylvania is, to be very candid, that they've got a disproportionately high number of older white voters. The Hispanic Latino population of Pennsylvania, relatively minuscule, ditto with the Asian population. So whether or not the African-American vote in, clustered largely in the cities is able to turn out in large numbers and overcome that remains to be seen. But I do have some concerns over the messianic aspects of any campaign. I mean, we saw that in 2008 with Barack Obama, and I believe there are a lot of folks that are terribly disappointed because he didn't, as James called it, come across. And the Republican Party that I've been a part of for 40 years has always been a party based upon principles, not personalities. And I think that's a very dangerous position that they find themselves in when they get off of that track.
Well, we did look up Philip Berg. One of my producers did. He was the Democratic chair of Montgomery County, did bring the lawsuit against Obama claiming he was born in Kenya, also filed a suit claiming that Bush and 155 other people were complicit in the September 11th attacks, just to get some information out there.
There you go.
There you go. So you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me just pick up on, and I'm looking at Donald Trump's speech that he gave yesterday about all the things that he was going to do if he becomes president. And Howard, he says he's going to appoint judges who will uphold the Constitution. He's going to change immigration rules. He's going to stand up to countries that cheat on trade. He's going to cancel rules and regulations that send jobs overseas, as if he's going to be the dictator of America and there is no Congress.
Yeah, that's... That's what he's doing politically. That's the promises he's making. And he's not bothering with the fine points as laid out by the founders in terms of the three branches of government. But we've sort of been heading that way for a while. I mean, I agree to some extent with Charlie about Barack Obama. I think he was his campaign was based in large part on who Barack Obama was, not primarily on the policies he was proposing. Right. He essentially said that when he said, "We are the change we've been waiting for," remember that from 2008, Barack Obama was saying, in effect, elect me, and because of who I am and because of my history, and if you don't know my history, go read the book that I wrote about myself, that electing me will change things by my own very nature, just by my own biography. Well, that was one step down the road toward the personality politics that we're talking about. Trump is taking a next leap. He's saying not only is it about who I am, but it's about what I can do by myself.
because of my experience and my will, and that somehow I'm going to be able to wave a wand and accomplish all these things because I am Donald Trump. That's dangerous. Mm.
But
that is quite dangerous and quite outside, for the most part, of the American tradition.
Let me pick up on that, Howard, because Hillary Clinton gets criticized for being overly pragmatic, for being kind of a policy wonk, for, you know, having 10-point plans to deal with X, Y, or Z. I mean, it sounds like you're saying we need someone like that, and yet that seems to be held against her.
Well, it's because of the era we're in. Don't forget that Congress's approval rating is, 10-12%. It's right down there with the mainstream media, of which I'm a part. you know, it's people are cynical and distrustful. And yes, and Hillary's also saying, in essence, I can work. It's we're all in this together. I can work with Congress. I know how to do it. I know how to use the community, both the one laid out by the Constitution of the United States and our social community, to get things done together. And Donald Trump has based that. So her slogan is still "It takes a village," including the Congress. Donald Trump's slogan, I guess, from Frank Sinatra, is "I did it my way." And that's the choice that, in addition to whatever substance there is in the campaign, that's the choice of approach that's happening right now.
And Charlie, we're almost up on a break here. He criticized Hillary Clinton's campaign mantra, "I'm with her," saying basically, "I'm with you," to the audience that he was addressing.
Well, that's a great soundbite. But the point that Howard made, you know, following up on one that I made earlier, I think is worth connecting on again. With Barack Obama, you had kind of this tabula rasa approach, which was there was this blank slate upon which people wrote their own hopes, ambitions, desires, and translated them to Barack Obama. And at least in the early stages of the Trump campaign, you saw a lot of that. And when you talked to the people that were so fervent to support him and asked why, couldn't really tell you. When you began to say, well, what about this? Didn't matter. What about that? Didn't matter. What about the other thing? Didn't matter, because their allegiance was really to that, I will do it my way, I'm not politically correct, and I'm going to break all the rules and win anyway.
And we got to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Charlie Giroux. He's a conservative columnist, a Republican strategist, an alternate delegate to the Republican National Convention in July, CEO of Quantum Communications, based in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Howard Feynman, global editorial director of the Huffington Post Media Group, and we are talking about campaign politics, the race for the White House, focusing a lot on Donald Trump, but also on Hillary Clinton. Well, let me play a clip from about 10 o'clock last night, a sit-in by Democrats in the House over gun legislation. And this is House Speaker Paul Ryan trying to resume business as usual as the House Democrats chanted.
The chair appreciates that members will differ on matters of policy and will seek to express those differences. But the chair would hope that the business of the House could be conducted in a fashion that respects positively on the dignity and the decorum of this institution to which we all belong.
Howard, they're saying no bill, no break. What was or is this all about?
Well, this is about a few things. One of them is the deep frustration that Democrats and others have about the inability of the Congress to pass even the most minimal new measures regarding gun safety, recognizing that they're constitutional issues. But still, there were four bills in the Senate. They weren't, in many respects, all that far apart. Can't they come to some kind of agreement on something? And the roadblock, even though the Senate leaders claim that they can probably get together on something, functionally, the roadblock is the House, where the Republicans have a solid majority and where they are in no mood to take up any bills, especially after the Senate has voted them all down. And House Democrats who come from, don't forget the context here in terms of the House is, the House is so gerrymandered, meaning that the districts are so drawn to make them essentially rotten boroughs for each party, There's not much room in between. There's hardly any middle left remaining. And the House Democrats, who for the most part come from solidly Democratic districts, want action. And they're frustrated and they're angry. And they hit upon this technique of calling upon the history of the civil rights movement to essentially equate the House of Representatives with the whites-only lunch counters of North Carolina in the 1950s. And it's thrilling culturally to them to be together on the floor of the House conducting this sit-in, demanding action on these gun law measures. I've talked to a lot of the House Democrats. There's deep emotion with this. They really want it. They think they're being unfairly blocked by Paul Ryan and the Republican majority in the House, and they went for it. And I got to say, I'm not sure what the politics of this are. I'd be interested to hear what Charlie has to say about this. But for these Democrats, and it's a multicultural, largely urban Democratic coalition, and again, you have this, I hate to dwell on race, but you have this race component on it. If you look at the Pew studies of who supports and opposes, quote, gun control, unquote, it breaks down very dramatically along racial lines with, older white, culturally conservative voters being in favor of not supporting any new gun control measures, and urban, multicultural, younger people supporting them. And you're seeing that playing out on the floor of the House right now.
And Charlie, as we know, Pennsylvania is a big gun state, if I can put it that way. How do you think this will or could possibly play out, this issue play out in Pennsylvania, presidential politics-wise, in the fall?
Pennsylvania is a big Second Amendment state, Marty. And politically, I think this move last night was disastrous for the Democrats. I mean, I frankly wish that the House cameras had been on, they were turned off, so that the whole country could have seen these theatrics played out on the floor of the House last night. I think it would have inured to the Republicans' benefit in a variety of states. If you just look at one simple statistic, which I think is very telling, in key battleground states, if you look at the number of right-to-carry permits, people who have voluntarily gone to various administrative agencies within their states to get the right to carry a concealed deadly weapon, a gun, Florida, pivotal state, number one in the nation, Pennsylvania, pivotal state, number two in the nation, Ohio, top 10 in the country, over a million people in Pennsylvania, Marty, all of whom are voters and who have families, majority of whom are women. So this issue does not play well in Pennsylvania for Hillary Clinton and the Democrats beyond.
Well, it'll be interesting to see as it unfolds. Let me give out that phone number again, and it's 1-888-477-9499 to join the conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Howard, and actually, Charlie, I want to hear from you as well. Howard, what do you make of the Free the Delegates campaign where a number of Republicans are saying we want to be free to vote at the Republican convention to vote our conscience?
Well, as usual, when there is an actual convention, and it's been very rare in modern times. I mean, there have only been a couple, really, in the last half century. I think the key is the Rules Committee. And it is true that if they change the rule, all hell could break loose on the floor of the Republican convention in Cleveland. But the one thing that Paul Manafort does know about American politics and its mechanics is conventions. He trained with James Baker going back a generation or two to the famous Republican convention in Kansas City, which was a rules fight and a vote fight between Ronald Reagan, the insurgent, and Gerald Ford, who'd taken over the presidency. So I think that the Trump people will be able to. I'm just guessing here, and I haven't done a survey of each member of the Rules Committee, and I haven't looked at the detailed mechanics. I think they'll be able to forestall that in Cleveland. If they can't, if they can't win the rule in the Rules Committee in Cleveland, then who the hell knows what's going to happen on the floor?
Well, you're going to be there, Charlie. What do you anticipate?
Well, I've done the same whip count that Howard has done, which is none at all. But I would just say that instinctively, I doubt very, 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 very seriously that this is going to prevail in the Rules Committee because of the obvious fallout if it were. A couple of points to be made, though. One, there are no rules until the Rules Committee decides what they are. Each convention decides and determines its own rules for that convention. In other words, the ones from the 4 years previous don't automatically apply to the new convention. But the very fact that we're having this discussion is, to me, the problem that the Trump campaign has right now, and that is that a significant number of Republican leaders are still not comfortable with him as a candidate, haven't endorsed him, haven't unified the ticket, and haven't come around to doing any of the blocking and tackling which is so necessary to be successful in November. I think that's the principal challenge of the Trump campaign right now. The period between the end of the primaries and the convention has typically been the defining period for candidates, the opportunity to define yourself and your opponent. And both candidates are trying to do that in the public arena. But behind the scenes, it has always been the period when you had to unify the party and put together the actual mechanics of running a campaign. And that's where the Trump campaign, at this juncture anyway, is lagging significantly behind.
And before I get some more callers in to you, Howard, he's leaving today for Scotland to check on his golf courses or his resorts. Some people are scratching their heads.
Well, with Trump, business comes first still. And I think that had a lot to do with why he attacked the Mexican-American judge in California. I mean, ultimately, Trump is a business enterprise. The Trump family is an ongoing business enterprise. And in their minds, that's even bigger than the presidency. And similarly with a golf course. I mean, he already has one golf course in Scotland. They welcomed him with open arms a decade ago. Now they can't stand him, of course. But he's going back to open another golf course. And the explanation that people give in his circle for why he's going is they said, well, this has been on his schedule for a long time. In other words, it predates the presidential campaign, and he's gonna do it, no question. Because don't forget, the three kids are involved in the campaign, and they're also involved in his business. That's Eric, Don Jr., and Ivanka. And ultimately, Trump views himself as the patriarch of a business empire. And he'll be damned if he's going to not take notice of what he views as one of his great triumphs, which is this new golf course.
Let me get
Plus he's of Scottish. He likes to talk about how he's of Scottish heritage. His mother was born in Scotland. He's an honorary Scot. He has a Scottish family crest. It all is of a piece with Donald Trump.
Let me get Gerardo from Philadelphia to join us. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. So first, let me be clear. In no way do I support Donald Trump or am I defending the things he does and says. But I wanted to get your guest's thought on, you know, a lot of people do not like Donald Trump because of the things he says about, for example, Latinos, immigrants, and Muslims. But, I mean, do people just forget some of the things that have happened to those same communities as a result of Hillary Clinton's past, you know, whether it's as Secretary of State and their role in the coup in Honduras, for example, and the way that negatively affected the Latino population there, Central Americans, and, you know, the her role in voting for the Iraq War in Libya and other things in the Middle East that have negatively affected, you know, the Muslim populations. You know, just kind of a different perspective on that, because as a progressive, those are parts of the reasons why I don't support Hillary either.
Fair enough. I mean, I think both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump have talked a lot about Hillary Clinton's vote and some of the policies that she supported in the Middle East. Do you want to take that, Charlie?
I think he raises a very, very important set of points, and I think he made them as well as I could make them. So I would just reiterate what he said, and those are the trigger points for an attack on Hillary Clinton. But again, as a candidate, the focus has to be on her, not on all of these tangential issues. And I think, by the way, that Howard is right about Judge Curiel and the attack that was made on him. I think that had much, much more to do with what political professionals would call inoculation over what may spill out on the Trump University case.
Do you want to respond, Howard, at all to what Gerardo just said?
Yeah, I think those are very interesting points, and I think that if Donald Trump weren't always talking at 150 decibels and always going for the most gut-punching emotional attack, he could make the kind of speech about Hillary's shortcomings, and she's got many good points, let's say, and you know, is worthy in many, many respects. But if you're going to go after her, the way to go after her is with the kind of detailed reasoned assault that will get the attention of undecided voters. I mean, I don't know what Charlie thinks, but I think that women, I think that white women professionals and their families in the collar counties of Philadelphia, for example, are going to be a key part of the what wins or loses Pennsylvania. And how do you reach those people with doubts about Hillary Clinton? You don't reach them with hysterical attacks about Hillary Clinton, because those people are already going to vote against Hillary Clinton. You reach them with more reasoned approaches, and that's what Trump is not very good at.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Howard Fineman, Global Editorial Director of the Huffington Post Media Group. Also with us, Charlie Giroux, a conservative columnist, a Republican strategist, an alternate delegate to the Republican convention in July. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Well, I guess while we're speculating to you, Charlie, at some point, Donald Trump's going to have to pick a running mate. Who do you think would be a good fit?
Well, I will go to the point that Howard just made very well, and he said, I don't know what Charlie thinks, but I think he's exactly right about the collar counties around Philadelphia, because I do believe that Trump has a strong appeal to Democrats in Washington County and Fayette County and Greene County, in the Wyoming Valley and Lackawanna and Luzerne County. But where he has a soft underbelly is with suburban middle-class to upper-middle-class women. And so, to me, putting a woman on the ticket with him would be a great advantage to overcoming some of the negatives that might still linger.
You don't have any in mind in particular, do you?
Well, I mean, I have some. I don't know whether they'd be willing to come.
Are her initials CF?
You get three quick ones who are all ethnic. Nikki Haley, Susanna Martinez, and Condoleezza Rice, I think, would all be terrific vice presidential running mates for Donald Trump. And, of course, I'm always a Newt Gingrich fan, so I'll throw that one
okay, in. Okay, fair enough. Howard, let me ask you about something. Whenever there's an article about Donald Trump on the Huffington Post, there's always this kind of a postscript saying Donald Trump is a liar, a xenophobe, a racist, a misogynist, right, and a birther, and it goes on from there. Are those your fingerprints there?
Well, I think that's a decision of the top editorial management, of which I'm a part, but led by Arianna Huffington, whose name is on the banner of the publication. And I think we tried an approach early on where we said, you know, this guy is, and this is at the start of the campaign, is not a serious person. And I think I would still, in certain respects, hold to that. But we were going to say, hey, we're not going to give him the dignity of taking him seriously as a traditional candidate, and we're going to cover him in the entertainment section. We decided to change that policy and to do this. And I think that if you look at that postscript and click on the links that we furnish behind the summary paragraph, you'll see that there's plenty. There's more than enough proof of every one of those statements, and we felt that given the fact that he is playing outside the traditional rules of politics, and I think in some dangerous ways, that we are going to flat out state at the bottom of every story a reminder of who he really is. It's controversial; people take note of it. And I think that's good. And it was a unanimous decision of all of us in the top management at the Huffington Post.
It also says he's equal parts Times Square con artist, human selfie stick, and David Mamet character. Just to finish that out.
Well, I don't think that's on every. That's not in every
well,
one.
That's what I'm looking at here. Howard Fineman, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Global Editorial Director of the Huffington Post Media Group, Charlie Giroux, thank you for joining us as well.
It was great to be with you. I'm going to have to put at the bottom of each one of my misses, Hillary Clinton, world's biggest liar, from now on.
Charlie Giroux, conservative columnist, Republican strategist, and an alternate delegate to the Republican convention. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.